Well, out of the many poems about the problems of Negroes and democracy that I've written, the one that perhaps has been most often reprinted and most often used by interracial groups is one called Merry-Go-Round. And maybe people have found it effective for interesting people in the race problem because it's a poem about a child. This poem was written shortly after the beginning of the war. Many Negroes were being brought up from the South, as every time a war happens, they are brought up by labor contractors and so on to work in the steel mills and factories of the big northern industrial cities. And I imagined a little girl of maybe 7 or 8 years old, or 9 or 10, who had grown up in maybe Birmingham or somewhere, coming up to, say, a city like Joliet or Chicago or Omaha with her parents. And the little girl goes to a carnival in a northern or western city, and she sees a merry-go-round going around, and she wants to ride, but she remembers down south where she's lived that there are a lot of things that colored people can't ride on. If they can ride, they have to ride in the back. And so this is what this little colored child, the little colored child at the carnival, says. The poem is called Merry-Go-Round. "Where is the Jim Crow section on this merry-go-round, mister? 'Cause I want to ride. Down south where I come from, white and colored can't sit side by side. Down south on the train, there's a Jim Crow car. On the bus, we're put in the back. But there ain't no back to a merry-go-round. Where's a horse for a kid that's black?" Well, of course, I feel that our country's big enough and rich enough to have a horse for every kid. And I think we will eventually achieve that. But we haven't yet, as you know. In spite of the very great advances that have been made in race relations, particularly in the North and in the far West, there are sections of our country where still a Negro kid can't ride on a merry-go-round at all. Well, I couldn't seem to make enough money to go to Howard in Washington as I wanted to, working as a busboy. So I got a scholarship to go to Lincoln through my poetry. Scholarship came to me on account of my poetry. I went to Lincoln University near Philadelphia, graduated from there in 1929, and ever since I've been making a living from writing. My father was a very practical man who lived in Mexico. He was a lawyer down in Mexico City, and when he found out I wanted to be a writer, he wouldn't send me any more money to help me be anything. He thought I was out of my mind. And so, during the years between my first semesters at college at Columbia and going back to college at Lincoln, I worked on the boats for about 2 years, and I went to Africa, went to Europe, and I'd always wanted to see Paris, so on one of my trips to Europe, a very rough and unpleasant trip in the middle of the winter anyway, didn't enjoy it very much, I decided to get off the boat and go to Paris. I'd studied French in high school, you know, I'd had 4 years of it, and I'd had a year of it at Columbia. So I thought, well, I speak French well enough to get a job in Paris, I'm sure. So I had $25 coming on the boat, I drew my money, didn't tell them I was going to Paris, they just thought I'd drew my money to spend in Rotterdam. I bought a ticket to Paris, got there very early in the morning, 7 o'clock on a cold, snowy morning, didn't know a human soul in all of Europe. But I thought I'd try my French out right away, so I was hungry, so I went up to the counter in the Gare du Nord and asked for ham and eggs at the lunch counter. Well, they looked at me and didn't seem to understand what I was saying, so I repeated, "Donnez-moi s'il vous plaît des œufs et du jambon." Looked at me again. I didn't know then the French don't eat ham and eggs for breakfast anyway, but I thought they might have understood the words. Didn't seem to understand the words either. So I saw the coffee urn over here and some rolls here. So I pointed at the coffee urn and I pointed at the rolls. And right away I got coffee and rolls. So I learned my very first morning in Paris that you don't really have to know the language in a foreign country to get along. You can just use sign language. You get anything you want, almost. Anything except a job. I couldn't find a job with sign language. I lived on coffee and rolls, or maybe I should say coffee and a roll for almost a month. per meal, just a coffee and a roll or something. Finally, I got a job as a doorman in a nightclub. Turned out to be a very tough nightclub, kind of underworld, gangster nightclub. And I didn't realize that if you were a doorman, you were also supposed to be the bouncer. And they used to fight in this nightclub with champagne glasses that they would smash on the edge of the table and then cut at each other with the jagged edges of the glasses. And they did this in all kinds of European languages. It was a kind of international club. So I never even knew what the fights were about, but I was supposed to stop them. So I didn't stay there very long. I found a job in another nightclub as a second cook. When they asked me could I cook, I said, oh, yeah. And I couldn't cook a thing in the world. But it turned out, fortunately, that the title second cook was honorary anyway. It really meant dishwasher. So it was something that I could do. And I'm telling you this because a whole phase of my poetic development grew out of my working in these nightclubs. The second nightclub where I worked had a very good Negro jazz band from New York. A little band, but it was an excellent one. Frank Withers was a member of it, one of the old jazz players you may have heard of, and Buddy Gilmore played drums in it, one of the great old-time drummers who since died. And so I used to hear this jazz band every night playing while I was washing dishes and pots and pans back in the kitchen, and the beat of this jazz music sort of got into my blood, and I began to try to reproduce it in poetry, to catch the rhythm of jazz in poems. And I think my jazz poems were probably the first of my poems to attract really wide attention outside of the literary circles of people who just read poetry anyway. This is one of them. It's a poem called Negro Dancers, and I read you this one because it will date the period for you. The period when I was working in Paris was the period of the Charleston, an American dance that began in New York, I guess, and just sort of swept all the way around the world. Josephine Baker, I think, brought it over to Europe, and everybody was trying to do the Charleston. So I wrote this poem called Negro Dancers at that time that goes like this. Me and my baby's got two more ways to do the Charleston. Da, 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 da. Two more ways to do the Charleston. Soft light on the tables, music gay, brown-skinned steppers in a cabaret. White folks laugh, white folks pray, cause me and my baby's got two more ways to do the Charleston. Well, I have since written quite a number of poems in which I try to capture some of the syncopation of jazz music in one style or another, and I would like to read you now some more recent ones, not really very recent, because these are of the bebop period, and those of you who know jazz music know that the bebop period was probably at its height around 1948, 49, 50 in there. These poems try to capture something of the idiom of the jive talk that lies behind bebop too. And as you know, many of the bop words or jive words have become a part of our American language, and you hear them on the radio, and the comedians use them all the time, and other people too. Everybody now knows what jive means, or cool, or dig, but 10 years ago, everybody didn't. This is a poem called Motto. It doesn't have anything really to do with music, but I'll read it to you as a kind of preliminary to one or two of the jazz or bop poems about the music itself. This is in Harlem Jive Talk, and it's about a cool cat, and it goes like this. I play it cool and dig all jive. That's the reason I stay alive. My motto, as I live and learn, is dig and be dug in return. Well, you know, in Harlem, we have a lot of night funerals. I don't know, I never saw night funerals in any other city myself. Maybe they have them in Chicago, don't know, but I don't remember ever seeing any. But in Harlem, almost every night, you can see a funeral or so going down 7th Avenue or Lenox Avenue. And I suppose the reason for these night funerals is that many of the mourners just couldn't get off from work to come to a funeral in the daytime. At any rate, they have the funerals at night, and then the deceased is buried early next morning with nobody there. This poem is a poem about the funeral of a hap cat, and it's called Dead In There. Dead In There. It goes like this. Sometimes a night funeral going by carries home a rebop daddy. Hearse and flowers guarantee he'll never hype another Patty. It's hard to believe, but dead in there, he'll never lay a hype nowhere. He's my ace boy gone away. Wake up and live, he used to say. Squares who couldn't dig him, plant him now, out where it makes no diff, no how. And now a poem called Flatted Fifths. Those of you who follow bop music know what flatted fifths are. Little colored boys with beards, rebop, bebop, mop and stop. Little colored boys with fears, frantic, kick their drafty years into flatted fifths and flatter beers that out of sudden change become sparkling oriental wines, rich and strange, silken bathrobes with gold twines, and Heilbrunner, Crawford, Nat undreamed of Lewis combines in silver thread and diamond notes on trademarks inside Howard coats. Little colored boys in berets, oop papa da, horse of fantasy of days, ooh yaku, and dig all plays. And then just a couple more about music. This one is called Jam Session. Letting midnight out on bail, Papa Da, having been detained in jail, oop, Papa Da, for sprinkling salt on a dreamer's tail, Papa Da, while bebop boys implore Mecca to achieve six discs with Decca. Little colored boys with fears, frantic, nudge their drafty years, Papa Da. Well, when I had my first book published, I didn't know whether people would really like my poems or not. I guess every writer feels that way about his writing. You wonder what's going to happen. And I really didn't know when I got out of college. That time I'd just finished my first novel. I wrote it on the campus in college, another instance of my literary work being tied up with my scholastic work. Didn't know quite how I was going to manage to live from this writing, but by that time I really wanted to be a writer and live from my writing. And I had the good fortune of being advised by Mary McLeod Bethune, the very great Negro woman who died about a year ago, head of the Bethune-Cookman College down in Florida, of being advised by her to take my poetry to the college students of the South and read it to them. And she said they will love your poetry and they'll buy your books and the schools will pay you something to come and read too. Well, I began to try to do it. I wrote a few letters, and sure enough, let's say out of 10 letters, I would get 6 answers back to come and read my poems. And I wondered how much I could charge. And so she said, well, I think the bigger schools at least could pay you $100. So I would start with $100. Some of the schools really would pay $100 to hear you read poetry, which seems to me amazing, you know? By the way, I'm not being paid $100 today. If I were, I'd read 2 hours instead of one. So anyway, when the answers would come back that they couldn't pay $100, then I would write a letter and say, well, since I'm going to be coming that way anyway, I will read my poems to you for $75. And sometimes then the answer would come back, well, we really just can't afford that on this campus, and our students are so poor, and our teachers' salaries haven't been paid for 2 months, and so on. So then I'd write and say, well, could you consider 50? And if they couldn't consider 50, I'd come down to 25. And if they couldn't consider 25, then I would write and say, well, I'm coming through there anyway, and I've always wanted to see your campus, and I would be delighted to read my poems to you in return for your hospitality overnight. And so the result was that I found myself reading my poetry somewhere almost every night all throughout the whole South. I had a little Ford car and I drove around. And my tour extended from New York all the way down to Florida, from Florida all the way across to Texas. And by that time, I'd gotten bold enough to ride to California. And so my very first lecture tour extended from New York to Florida to Texas all the way up the coast of Seattle. And I must have read my poems during that year, that winter, to maybe 50,000 or more students and other people.